Welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. I'm the producer, Caleb Keith, and I'm joined by our hosts, Drs. Rod Rosenblatt, Scott Keith, and Adam Francisco. Follow these great minds as they answer pressing questions about theology, history, and apologetics. This show is brought to you by 1517 The Legacy Project, serving to proclaim the gospel to all people, especially those broken by the church.
All right, I think we are on episode 4. This is the Thinking Fellows podcast. Welcome. Today our topic will be pretty simple, actually, but not simple. We're talking about grace, the doctrine of grace. What is it? When Christians use that word, what are we talking about, and why is it so significant? Why do we hear it all the time? There we go, Thinking Fellows podcast, episode 4. So, Rod, what do you think? When we talk about grace, we just did gospel. Right, these concepts came up a lot in that episode on the gospel. When we talk about grace, what is it? What are we talking about?
Well, at the simplest level, it's the opposite of law. But I've often complimented Sunday school teachers who had their little kids learn the acronym God's riches at Christ's expense.
Right. I use that in class still today.
Yeah, and I think that's a solid little beginning.
I do too.
I really do. We've got to distinguish it from Rome, where it's a kind of a substance shot into you, gratia infusa. But basically, it's God's favor towards sinners because of Christ's work for them. He is able to, as the Bible says, both be the justifier, just and the justifier of those who believe in Christ. Who would have thunk? God's favor, his smiling face, his good attitude rather than what we imagine, all because of Christ and his dying for us.
I often, when I teach this in class, I'll often say that it's an attitude on the part of God whereby he now sees you as his child.
Right.
Because of what Christ has done
right
for
on.
You. Christ in his dying work has paid the debt of your sins. He has ended the war between you and God, and now you belong to God in that most beautiful way where you're his child.
Yeah.
And that child
better than what I said.
That's, on account of
go
Christ.
With what he said. What God said.
I might mark that down, the date down for that. That's great. So we in Reformation churches, especially within Lutheranism, we often we have these solas, these phrases, these only phrases. Exclusive particles, as Melanchthon would say. These
alone.
Alone. These ways of talking about that alone, this is the way you are saved. And grace is one of those. We'll say sola gratia, grace alone.
Yep.
When we say grace alone, what are we talking about? It's a simple phrase to say, but it's packed full of meaning. What's the meaning behind that?
Well, one of the basics is that God saves us through Christ's death, and only this way. It has to be free because he said so. The only way in is where it's free, or it's based solely on his generosity. That's another possibility, benevolence toward us because of Christ. His attitude is, Paul says in Corinthians, it's all yes and no, no, because of Christ again, propter Christum. It's a yes, it's a yea, not a nay. And people will fight against this like crazy because it's just too good to be true. And they'll come back at you with anything they've got to reject it because they've been baited and switched before and they're not going to do it again. They're not going to be baited and switched again. I understand the dynamic of it. But what the Reformers said was the only way in is by Christ, and it's got to be free. It's got to be no expense. Or Paul uses the contrast between wages and gift. That's in the New Testament. That's another way to get it across. Or there's another one in Romans. If by this, then not by that. If by grace, then not by works.
I like the idea of wages and gifts. I mean, wages are those things that you're paid.
Yep.
And you get, you go do something. Somebody hires you.
Yep.
And they say, hey, you do X, Y, and Z. And upon completion of Z,
yep.
I will then turn over a certain amount of whatever reward to you. You've done it.
Yep.
Here you go.
Contractual,
yep. Right? And
yep.
Obligation is on both parties, right? Mm-hmm. The person who's offering to pay, the person's offering to do the work. A gift, though, a gift is something different. And I, you and I talk a lot about fatherhood. Rod and I talk a lot, and even Adam and I talk a lot about fatherhood. And this, I think we've, in so many ways, because of the American ideal of working things out yourself, rugged individualism,
yep.
Horatio Alger, pulling yourself up by your bootstraps,
yep.
And that if you just work hard enough, anything can happen. Anybody can be president. Anybody
yep.
can be Bill Gates if you just are willing to put your nose to the grindstone.
Yep.
We have a hard time with the idea of gift.
Yep.
It's almost in everything we do, sometimes even with birthdays and Christmas and these things that seem like the natural end to the idea of a gracious gift, an actual gift. We have a hard time with it.
Yep.
And we turn it into a wage. Right, we turn it into a this for that. How does that lead to confusion on the part of the everyday Christian when we actually use the word grace and we call it a gift that somehow works make their way back in?
I think the usual is what Adam has said about Islam. I think people translate mercy, but it isn't what the Bible word means. They're two different words. Grace is seen in the parable of the prodigal son in the sense that he's not given a second chance to do better. That's not any part of the conversation. He doesn't even get to say his speech about hire me as a servant. Pretty much that's gone too. The golden ring is put on his finger. The band is already warming up. The wine is being poured. And his father has run out this long distance, finally seeing him coming back again. And the other son says, Hey,
he didn't earn it.
Yeah.
I did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So but it's reinstatement as if he'd never gone out and screwed up. He's reinstated with the inheritance again, not just given a second chance. Second chance isn't in the parable.
Right.
It's reinstatement.
That's an interesting point. It's really not. Right, it's not delineated like you screwed up the first chance. Now the second chance. Let's see how you do with that.
Yep,
that's not really what it is there.
Nope.
So Adam, contrast that a little bit for us with other world religions, even Islam a little bit. The idea of the difference between grace and mercy. Is Christianity really the only religion that has grace like this?
Boy, every religion at this point is different. You know, with Islam, Dr. Rosenblatt said there is the Quran is just filled with all sorts of descriptions of Allah being merciful, but not gracious. That is, he doesn't have this disposition mm-hmm. that of just liking us just because he likes us. Other religions, there's not. You'll hear the term grace, but it means something entirely. It's just sort of a term that's used. There's no substance to it. There's no. It's not. It's just a word that's used. It is not connected to some sort of disposition of God, because a lot of other religions don't really have this view of God as an independent thing.
Mm-hmm.
Think Hinduism, Buddhism, at all. Everything's sort of God.
Yep.
Everything's part of God, and so grace wouldn't even make sense.
Yep.
At least the way we're defining grace in that sort of
yep.
worldview. I don't know what else is there.
I don't know. I think you brought up. I don't know how much time to spend on this, but you brought up something that's interesting to me. Is that early on at Concordia, one of the things that Dr. Rosenblatt taught me, and I'm sure you too, is to be very careful with terms.
Mm.
You know, be very careful with terms, because I can say grace and I can mean one thing,
mm-hmm.
and I can enter in a conversation with my friend Adam, and I can start using the word grace, God has grace on you, Jesus has grace on you, and I can believe in my head that that's a very common word, so Adam will understand exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And to hear you say that other religions to sort of use this term, but they are not meaning a free gift on account of Christ,
even
or even a free
Christianity.
Gift.
I mean, think the late Middle Ages, Reformation period. The reformers used the word grace and used it in a way
Rome
that we, as a disposition.
27 different kinds of it.
Yeah, yeah. And for Rome, it's kind of an infused substance.
Yep.
And one of the big breaks I think that the reformers make was redefining grace.
Yep.
Defining it more along biblical lines than this sort of Aristotelian scholastic view of Rome.
Well, perhaps one of the biggest changes in the Reformation was this redefinition.
Yeah, I think
yes.
so.
Yes. Absolutely.
It was taught late Middle Ages, back in the High Middle Ages, where it began, who knows, but that grace is something that's put in you. It's almost like you work for it, whether it be through taking part of the in the sacramental system, maybe going to behold a relic somewhere. God would put grace into your account, so to speak. This substance.
Yep,
you know?
Power, and sort of gas in the tank.
Yeah,
a little help.
And it would... The more grace you built up, the it was almost like you worked for it, and God was kind of not required, but obliged to give it to you.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you do what's within you, you know, God will not deny you grace.
That
was the late medieval phrase.
Yep.
And the reform Luther was trained in this school in late medieval nominalism, which that was their doctrine of justification or part of it. And finally came to realize when, we don't know, 15, 16, or somewhere thereabouts, that was not the biblical definition.
Yep.
A lot of historians talk about Luther's theological breakthrough. I think that was integral to it.
Sure.
Seeing grace as something that's not a substance, but simply God's attitude or disposition towards his creation.
I think that gets right to the center of it.
Yeah. Right, and I think that the idea too that this is a gift is powerful. And again, I want to go back to this what I started talking about, saying I don't think we get that. I don't think we understand gifts, to be honest with you. I wrote a blog piece on this on Jagged Word, and I always use the story in my class when talking about it. I'll try not to take too much time, but when I was growing up, I was 10 or 11. I really wanted a real BMX bike, like a real one.
Mm-hmm.
We had this BMX jumping track right across from my house. And I had essentially what today we'd call a little kid's Walmart bike, you know, mm-hmm. not capable of going over to the jumping track. And by this point in time, all of my friends had the real BMX bike and they were out there jumping, and I really wanted one. And so my school that I went to in Lancaster, California, was only about a block and a half away from the only real bike shop that I knew of around, Gill's Bike Shop. A little plug there for Gill. And my friend Justin and I, every Friday for about 6 weeks, would ditch school on our lunch break because Mr. Paraguay would sit in his desk and read a newspaper and not pay attention to us. And we'd ditch and we'd go look at bikes at this bike shop. And I picked out this great black and gold Red Wing bicycle that I just lusted after this thing. I wasn't aware of girls yet, but bikes I knew. And I wanted this bike. And I remember one day riding home in the car with my mom, telling her that I really wanted this bike and that I had the one picked out that I wanted. And it was at Gill's Bike Shop, and it was a black and gold Red Wing, and Christmas was coming up, and I thought it'd be a really good option for her to go get me. Well, just as I said that, I betrayed myself, because she knew that she had never driven me to Gill's Bike Shop to look at bikes. And the question came out, how do you know that there's a black and gold Red Wing at Gill's Bike Shop? And all of a sudden, you know, I think I tried to weasel my way out of it unsuccessfully. And it came out that Justin and I, it's hard for me to tell, my friend Justin just died. Justin and I had been ditching school to go look at this bike. And so I pretty much knew in my head that there was no way in hell this black and gold Red Wing would be there for me on Christmas morning, because I think even at a very young age, I had already learned the wrong idea of gift and the wrong idea of grace, which is that I didn't earn this bike, right? I hadn't been a good enough boy to get this bike. In fact, I'd been the opposite. I had been the bad boy. I had ditched school at 10 or 11 years old. Wiener Schnitzel was right by Gill's too, so that made it a plus. But And so I wake up on Christmas morning, and I'm actually, my mom nailed Christmas every year. So every Christmas I was very excited to get up. And this Christmas I kind of thought, well, I'm going to take my time because the bike's not going to be there. And instead of running out at 6 a.m., I moseyed out of my room at about 8:30 to see this heap of wrapping paper next to the tree, which I knew was this gift that I didn't deserve at all. And I ripped the paper off, and there was my black and gold Red Wing bike. And I think with slippers and 4 inches of snow on the ground and my PJs, I headed right out to Tarzan Hills and went and rode through the mud and the muck and over to my friend Justin's house to show him that I actually got the bike. That's a night. That's a concept of gift, of a gracious gift that we just don't have.
Yep.
All right. And I say to this day, that bike, that gift changed my world.
Yep.
It made me realize that there is something remarkable to a gift that you don't earn.
Yep.
And when we talk about grace being this gracious gift of God on account of Christ, whereby he adopts us as his children, when we deserve the opposite,
yep.
While you were yet sinners, Christ died for you.
Yep.
That if my little red line bike that 18 months later got stolen changed my world so much, how much more does the gift of God's grace on account of Christ change every world?
The average American knows that can't be true. And it's because of what you mentioned earlier. Our whole life is something else. It's the opposite.
Yeah. It's earned.
It's earned.
Merit.
Yep.
Did you merit this?
Yeah. It's like at Christmas time. I have mixed feelings about Christmas. For a variety of reasons, but it always, for a long time, it's just agitated me that gift giving on Christmas is connected with how good
yep.
you've been. And parents, I'm guilty of it myself, can kind of lord the giving of gifts on Christmas Day over their kid's head.
Sure.
Santa's not going to bring you a good gift.
Right.
My wife, I'm going to pick on her. I love her dearly. She's remarkable.
And she's a remarkable mom, by the way.
Yeah, yes. She's incredible. Does more than
yes.
maybe four wives. If I had four wives, she'd do more than all four of them. But
yep.
who would want four wives? But
God don't curse us with four wives.
One Christmas, our kids were just, man, they were being pains, as kids are, leading up to Christmas. And my wife was, that's it. You're not getting squawked, you know?
Crossed the line.
Yeah, they ended up getting lots of stuff, but I kind of felt the same way, you know? But, you know, at Christmas morning, there's nothing like when you, like, I always go on Amazon. You know, even my wife has, we've got a list of gifts that the kids want. They put them, made a list, and we get those things by and large. Then I always get these gift cards from my insurance company gives me gift cards if I fill out this stuff on whether I've eaten well that year and so on. So I'll go on Amazon and just buy whatever the heck I want to give the kids. And so the kids get these gifts, which they're so thankful for because we don't just go out and buy things for them normally. And then on top of it, they get more things. And it's like
yep.
They'll cry. They're so happy. They can't. Even my son, my oldest son, who has no affection for anybody or anything.
Uh-huh.
You know, he's at that stage where he doesn't want to even hug his mom. You see on Christmas morning that he just goes up spontaneously, goes and hugs mom and dad and says thank you.
It's magic.
Even if it's from Santa, he does it covertly so his younger siblings don't know that Santa doesn't really exist, but. It's magical.
That sort of grace,
and it's so counterintuitive or opposed to how we conceive of when we should get gifts or when
yep.
we should get stuff. You've got to earn it. You got to fulfill some sort of obligation.
Yep.
To get something in return.
Yep.
Because that's our whole life.
Yeah,
it is. It's like we discussed in the last podcast. Our whole life is framed by the law and our obligation. And if you want it, you better earn it.
Yep.
And in the world, that's true.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, that's just the way things work. It's
sure.
nature.
Yeah. Sure.
But thanks be to God through Jesus Christ, our Lord, that in God's grace on account of Christ, that's not the truth.
Yeah. It isn't true in everything. There's one free lunch in the universe. Propter Christum.
And it's much more than lunch.
Yep.
All right, we got a good time for a break there, producer Caleb?
Yes, we are.
All right, break time.
All right, welcome back from our break. We're going to take this opportunity to once again highlight one of our books. We've highlighted this book in the past, but because the title and the subject matter of the book is so relevant to grace, we're once again going to highlight Being Dad, Father as a Picture of God's Grace. Dr. Scott Keith is the author of that book, and Dr. Keith, would you take a second to tell everybody again maybe what the book's about, or more how it corresponds with our topic today on grace?
Sure. The idea of the book, again, got from Dr. Rosenblatt while at Concordia, was just sort of unique picture of what place does the father serve in the home? What is the father's vocation in the home? And the book, basically, I do my best in it to sort of lay out this picture that God places good fathers in the home for a multitude of reasons. Some of them are, I guess you could say, sociological and just oriented at the family life. But in reality, if we were to take sort of a grander view of even jumping off of the prodigal son, that what the father does in the home is he's a mouthpiece of grace to his family, to his children specifically, that he is that person from whom they first get these magical gifts, these gifts, these unheard of things, it's too good to be true. Parents can do this generally. Mothers can certainly do this, but at the end of the day, that really it's the father's role. And the book is an attempt to encourage men to do just that, to give them a positive picture of what their place is in the house from a particular perspective, from the perspective of you are here to point your children to a good and gracious God by being in some way, some foggy way, that picture to them in the home. So in it is, you know, are some stories. There's an introduction by Dr. Rosenblatt about where this concept first came from that he got from Dr. Paul Fairweather. Do just a brief, very basic exegesis of the story of the prodigal son. And from there, move on to just different pictures. What a masculine father looks like in the home, what a father is as husband as well, what a father is as provider of magical moments, what a father is as a mouthpiece of grace, the type of home that a father constructs, not the physical building, but the ethos of the place. And the whole book is supplemented by stories of other men who are fathers, who provided, graciously provided the gift of their stories to the work, and just over and over again trying to set up this picture that if we are to talk about a God who is gracious, in other words, a God who is one who gives us the free gift of our salvation and our freedom, our victory over sin, death, and the devil on account of Christ, with none of our works having anything to do with it or playing into it at all, that he provides fathers to do that same type of thing in a foggy or in an obscured picture way in the home, and how important that is for children to first become accustomed to that idea in their earthly dads, and then when they see it in their heavenly father, it's not as much of a surprise that such a thing could possibly be true. So that's Being Dad, Father is a Picture of God's Grace. You can buy it on 1517, The Legacy Project. It's also available on Amazon. I was told today that Amazon is paying for their own promo of it or some such thing.
Yeah, when you... maybe not for everybody, but in your cache, if you search Being Dad, you can now see an ad pop up from Amazon about that particular book, which is kind of exciting news. We didn't pay for those ads.
So. My own son, producer Caleb, produced a little video of sort of promoting the book, too, that is available now at 1517 Legacy as well. So where can they get it at 15 Legacy?
Yeah, so shop.1517legacy.com. is where you can buy the book. You can also, like you said, find it on Amazon. The book is available in three or four formats: soft cover, hardcover, ebook, and now we have an audiobook version. So we're very excited about that.
The audiobook is tremendous, by the way. We put that thing out to bid on some audiobook out to bid thing. I don't know what the name of it. And we had, I think, over 50 people offer to read it. And the gentleman we went with is English, so he's got a British accent, which is kind of fun. But he responded to us saying, I've read the book. I believe in the project. You don't have to pay me anything up front. because I believe in it, and I'll promote it on my end too. And so it was great. We're just doing a share of royalties for his reading because he believed in the project. And when he reads it, you can tell that he believes it. And it's just, it's wonderful. The gift awesome. Keeps giving.
Really fantastic. And a perfect way to kind of segue back into our topic of grace.
Yeah, we just have maybe just a couple things left to talk about. I want to get back to this idea that in most of modern Christianity, maybe even evangelicalism, this picture that we've been talking about as grace as a free gift, is that the picture that's out there?
Sort of. In evangelicalism, sort of. It's what Dr. Mansky called years ago law, gospel, law. Or what the image I've used is a young couple getting baited and switched at a car lot. That is...
That's been me, by the way.
It's been really well presented by all kinds of evangelical pastors, but you don't get told that there's another shoe that's going to drop. And that is that the law is going to come back in a different way, in such a way that the person will say, I've been baited and switched. And the way I've tried to get beyond that is to say, look, it's got to be grace in the beginning. Evangelical's pretty good at that. It's got to be grace in the middle. They're not so great at that. And it's got to be grace at the end. Solely grace, only grace. That limits the playing field. You're going to have to find some kind of a Reformation church that's going to make good on that promise.
Yeah, you produced an audio recording on just this topic, actually, that's gone, I think the modern word is it's gone viral online, called The Gospel for Those Broken by the Church. Mm-hmm. And in that audio recording, you discuss a little bit what that, you know, a misunderstanding or missing that grace in the middle can produce. Can you summarize that for us a little bit?
Well, it's a wonderful message that salvation is by grace only or solely. The question is, are you going to stay with that? And the way I tried to do it in the paper was to say, most Christians would say yes to a person being drawn to Christ in a saving way. It's by grace.
In other words, grace alone as a matter of conversion or first coming to the faith, first becoming a Christian, is kind of obvious to everybody.
Right.
Yeah.
But the next question is, once you're a Christian believer, are you still saved solely by the death of Christ? That gets dicey. Mm. Now, the Lutheran's going to say, you bet, but he's going to get a whole bunch of blowback from other believing Christians that were doing something somehow illegitimate. And that's why I think of that old Appalachian lady in Catherine Marshall's Christie. She realizes in her dying, all she's got is the blood of Christ. All she's got is the cross. That lady's a good theologian, even if uneducated.
Right. So before we went, or during the break, we were continuing to discuss the topic a little bit. And Dr. Francisco brought up that we should discuss a little bit this idea that Paul brings up, actually, in Romans chapter 6, verse 1, where he says, what shall we say then? Shall we go on sinning so that grace may increase, or sometimes translated so that grace may abound? Mm-hmm. Now, what's the answer to that?
I remember one little bit of Greek, megenesthai, at this point, variously translated, God forbid, or may it never be. He's been doing 5 chapters of grace solely, based on Christ's death solely, and he knows, never having been to Rome, he knows what somebody's going to ask then, so he puts it in their mouth in Romans 6:1. Well, if I'm tracking with you, Paul, then probably you are saying that we should sin more so that there's more grace abounding. And he says, God forbid, or may it never be. He knew that's what somebody was going to ask, and he was right. That's exactly the question it leads to.
Right. He responds in verse 2, by no means, or may it never be, we died to sin. How can we live in it any longer? Do you have any words on that, Dr. Francisco?
Well, just going back to Dr. Rosenblatt's comment, there's a theological term. I don't remember the Latin anymore, but the opinion of the law.
Mm-hmm. Opinio legis.
Opinion legis.
That's it. As a final.
Yeah. The opinion of the law, and it's in every human right. being.
Yeah. It's what I mean. At the end of the day, it's at the groundwork of when I said that our entire existence is framed by the law.
Yeah.
That's the reality there.
And that's why I mean this message of God's grace is so it's alien.
Yep.
It's so counterintuitive.
Yep.
It just doesn't make sense that it can be that easy or yep. that there are no yeah. catches. There's no.
Yep.
In Santa Barbara, I kept saying that the goal of evangelism and apologetics even is to push that burgeoning believer, that questioning person, to the cross so that they can face the scandal of the cross, right?
Yeah.
And there was a very well-meaning older lady who came to me after the session, and she said, and she has a very broken voice, and she said, "I'm struggling with the scandal of the cross. Can you explain to me why the cross is scandalous?" And my answer was just that you know, this there's two part, in my mind there's two parts to the message of grace on account of Christ alone that is scandalous. The first one is that it took the death of God yep. to actually pay for your sin. Your sin was so deep
yep.
that it took the death of God, or Jim Destigan would say deicide, uh-huh. right? That God had to be killed
yep.
and to pay for it. That's absolutely scandalous. The second part of the scandal there is that it's just so contrary to everything that we've ever been taught.
Yep.
That a free gift is the answer. A free gift on account of Christ is the answer to the problem. It takes the way our mind is framed, and it turns it upside down mm-hmm. and almost inside out, so that we don't even, you know, we don't know what to do anymore.
So good works, how do they fit? I'll throw the question out rather than answering.
Luther would say, they will come, not by your...
God's already prepared them.
Yes. The picture in Ephesians is he's prepared them beforehand for you to walk in them, but they're not saving in the way that the blood of Christ is.
Right. Right. Melanchthon had an interesting take on this, and he sometimes was all over the board on it, but jumping off of Ephesians 2:10, you know, that God has prepared these yep. good works in advance so that you can do them, or a great translation is so that you can walk in them, is that good works are a natural result of being saved on account of Christ alone. We tend to get the cart before the horse, right? We want to have this discussion about our salvation and say, well, mm-hmm. we want to go back to the opinio legis, right? Mm-hmm. We want to reframe the conversation mm-hmm. Under the context of the law. And when I teach this at Concordia, I jump off of the bicycle story again, and I say, okay, so if this is right, in from the Apostle Paul in Ephesians 2:10, and if I understand that the reformers explain this correctly, and using my frame of reference from Melanchthon, what Melanchthon would say is it's the walking in your everyday life as a Christian, right? The good works that you're walking in, they're not, we tend to think of them as helping old ladies across the street with their groceries and giving a certain amount of money to whatever charity and just doing all these extra things, and really it's the everyday life, the calling in your vocation and living that, and they come naturally. From the bicycle story, I often will say, listen, nobody had to tell me to go ride that bike.
Yeah.
Nobody yeah. had to say, wow, that bike is so great, you better jump on it and go ride it. Hey, and while you're at it, be sure you go show your friend Justin, and be sure you go show your friend Kevin, and ride over to grandma's house and show her, because they'll want to know about it too. I didn't even have to think about that.
Yeah.
I got the gift, jumped on the bike, went and jumped it 10 or 15 times, rode over to Justin's house, said, holy crap, look at this. I got it anyway. Rode over to Kevin's house and said, did you see this? Rode over to grandma's house and said, look at what I got. In other words, we come to knowledge of this grace through the gospel. And then once we are in his grace, the gospel is the foremost thing on our minds when we actually believe that it is a free gift from God. We share that message with others. Melanchthon would say that it was in the sharing of that message in your everyday life that the good works play out, but that they're never salutary. They're never meritorious, as yep. they would say. They don't earn you anything. Yeah. It's still not a payment scheme.
Yep.
Like we like to
important.
Think. It's a reaction. It's a reaction. It's like when you go to the doctor and he hits your knee and your leg jumps out, you know, testing your reflexes. It's a reflex. So good works have a place. We should do a whole show on good works.
Is it Bonhoeffer? Yeah. I always see this quote from Bonhoeffer who says that God doesn't need your good works, but your neighbor does. Is that?
Well, that's in Luther.
That's Luther. Okay.
I think so.
Okay. I should probably know that.
And he was. I think that's correct. And it's very important.
Yeah.
Extremely important. Yeah. If a person starts getting this for the first time, I don't care if they've been attending some Christian church for 40 years, you can still have people who get this for the first time. You don't lie awake nights anymore fretting and worrying.
Right.
You don't.
Right. Luther stops whipping himself.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That sort of Damocles that's always been there and all of a sudden it's removed, your life becomes less fretting. The ultimate question has been answered on your behalf by somebody else and to your benefit, and it's done.
For the consolation of the sinner, as the reformers would have said. This is for the consolation of the sinner.
Yeah.
And by the way, that's you. If you have been received, it's only sinners who are received into God's grace on account of Christ. So if you have been, you're one of them. You are a sinner, and this is for your consolation.
Yep.
Freely. That leads us a couple more things here. I eventually want to ask the question, where does this leave us? But in the blogosphere these days, there are a lot of questions about, is there a difference between grace and the gospel? Now, I think that's maybe not such a helpful question, but I do think some of our listeners may have run across this sort of idea. What do we think on that? Is there a difference between grace and the gospel?
I don't know if I'll be that much help on that one. Well,
I don't know if there is much help on it. Do you have anything, Adam? Or Stalin?
We've done what is the gospel and we've done what is grace. That kind of a question I don't face very often. There are not many people have asked me that one.
Yeah, I work in history and Islamic studies, so I don't get that much, but I'm thinking maybe grace precedes the gospel. It's God's liking us.
Right.
Yeah, so as sinners, at our worst.
While we were sinners, that he sent his son. Mm-hmm. And so there is a difference, but they're integrally linked.
Right.
You know, if God wasn't gracious, he wouldn't have sent his son.
Mm-hmm. Right. The gospel is the message of God's grace.
Yeah, and you can't know God's gracious disposition towards you apart through
from
his
Christ.
Son.
Yep. Yeah.
Maybe you can assume it in a foggy way, but you'll never get assurance or real comfort.
Yep.
That's only through his son, through the personal work of Jesus.
So when you're announcing God's grace, you're announcing what has already occurred on account of Christ, that historical event, and that he now sees you differently. Mm-hmm. And then the gospel is the announcement or the proclamation of that message toward the end of bringing the person into that fold of grace, mm-hmm. right? Into that mm-hmm. that place where they now stand in that grace and they understand and they believe and they trust. Melanchthon often said, we'll do a show on faith, but it leads into the idea of what is faith, right? And he called it this heartfelt confidence, mm-hmm. that grace is really true.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah.
And if Paul is right, we're always up against this. It doesn't go away. The old Adam screams the opposite every single day. Luther was astounded that the Roman Catholic theologians saw the whole thing as so simple. And he was saying, what do you mean simple? Every single day, you're being drawn to believe something that's completely counterintuitive. You're going to rest your confidence on Christ and not on your growth, spirituality, or anything else. That's got to not have any confidence in it. If you're in column J for justification, it's only Christ.
Yeah, there's no traction in going back to yourself here.
No, no. The self Luther saw as the problem. And 20th century America sees the self as the real answer. Right, finding your true self. Luther would say you're dead wrong.
Yeah, you'll only find death there.
Yeah.
Right. So maybe we just hit it, but is that where this leaves us? Where does this leave us when we talk about grace and sola gratia, grace alone?
Propter Christum. I think it's the only way we live without going mad. Chesterton talked a lot about going mad. I think this gospel is the only thing that keeps us from going mad. And it's in line with what the New Testament says and placing our confidence in that. And it means I'm not going to place my confidence in me.
Right. I think we end there. What do you think?
That sounds like a great...
All right. So what we'll talk about, I think what we're finding out is that show 5 and 6 will probably be number 5 on faith and number 6 on good works. And we'll flesh this out a little bit more. And as we close out, we've got one more little message for you regarding one of our other projects. What are we hitting this time?
So on the spotlight this week is the League of Faithful Masks, which tries to bridge the gap between kind of society, other faith groups, and Christianity and this idea of grace. Dr. Francisco, you're a fellow of the League of Faithful Masks. Could you tell us a little bit about that project?
Yeah, well, it actually has a pretty long history. I think it's been around for almost 10 years now. Uva Zimaneto, a journalist and academic lay theologian who now lives in Southern California, started it in St. Louis, Missouri, at the Concordia Seminary, and it's kind of moved here. It's as their mission statement is that the League of Faithful Masks champions a Judeo-Christian worldview of vocation as an effective antidote to the destructive narcissism of contemporary society. It promotes the Lutheran doctrine of vocation in its diverse efforts to oppose narcissism, and where while its board members and the people involved are Lutheran through and through, the League still considers itself very non-sectarian, eager to reach out to all faithful Christians and believing Jews while serving the community at large, irrespective of religious affiliation.
You know, that sounds like the Augsburg Confession, where they said we're writing this for the whole Christian church on earth.
Right.
And it's
in one accord.
Our friends at the League of Faithful our friends at Virtue and Way in the Wasteland, they're underneath League of Faithful Masks.
Right, yeah. Well, they're all underneath now, 1517 Legacy Project, but they were, Virtue in the Wasteland began, I guess you could say, as a project of the League of Faithful Masks. Okay, yeah. Great, thank you.
All right, so if you would like to find out more about the League of Faithful Masks, you can go to faithfulmasks.org, and of course, go to 1517legacy.com to find out more about all of our projects. And if you feel like donating to Faithful Masks, any of the other projects, this show, you can go and find the big red donate button in the top right corner at 1517legacy.com.